This is Car Expert.
Volkswagen and Wagtra haven't gone over the top. It could be one of the coolest looking utes out there.
Customer Management 101, these are your most loyal, hardcore fans. Don't piss them off.
The Tucson's actually now based on a shortened version of the Santa Fe and Kia Sorento platform. It's sort of got like a big car feel in a smaller car package.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner and a big welcome to Mike Costello this week.
Hello, Mandy.
And Scott Colley, hello.
Hey, Mandy.
Hey, Moco, apparently we touched last week that you own a Suzuki Jimny, which no one knows about.
I can hear the sarcasm dripping out of your voice as you say that.
Oh, absolutely. Look, I'm sort of excited that you actually bought a Jimny. This is probably a couple of years ago now when it was released.
Yeah, so almost 2 years ago to the day that I got mine.
Fantastic. And you've written an article on Car Expert called Why I Bought a Suzuki Jimny. So why did you buy one?
Yeah, so we've got this running series of stories that we're all doing. We think it's really important as editorial guys and girls to actually have skin in the game and buy new vehicles if possible. We recommend people buy new cars, so why should we be any different? And I bought mine because I don't need a sensible vehicle. You know, I don't have kids, and if I do need a van or a ute or something, it's quite easy for me to get hold of one in the form of a press car. So I may as well buy something ridiculous. I'm a country kid. I grew up with old Suzukis on the farm. I love going off-roading, and it's adorable. Like, it's such a cool little thing, and I really love the fact that Suzuki is willing to actually make a body-on-frame, live-axle, you know, manual 4x4 in this modern era. It's such a throwback car, and I felt like it was incumbent on me to kind of reward the brand for actually bothering. So for all those reasons, of course, I've owned it for 2 years and done about 11,000 Ks in it because I almost never drive it because, you know, we're all driving so many cars for our work. It is more often than not just a nice-looking ornament. the good news is demand is so high for them, it's not exactly going backwards in value either. So I just wrote a piece just talking about my experiences with it so far. Obviously, Al Bors has got one himself and he's done horrendous modifications to his, so I thought it was important to show the readers what a really good modified Jimny looks like, and just to kind of explain my pros and cons of actually having the car.
There's a lot of stuff about the Jimny that is really endearing when you have it for 2 days or 3 days or for a week. Is there anything about the car you're starting to get tired of after 2 years?
So many things. Yeah, like it doesn't have a sixth gear, so on any highway it sits at 3,700 RPM. You know, the infotainment system cost $1.50 because Apple CarPlay like works half the time and doesn't work another half of the time. I've put aftermarket wheels on it without really doing the suspension mods that you should do with it, so the ride quality is not very good, but that's kind of on me, to be honest with you. I'm telling people in the experience center a lot when I'm up there, that people who are looking at the Jimny, is make sure you know what this car is. This is not a sensible inner city small SUV that's designed for urban commuting like a Mazda CX-3, and it shouldn't be cross-shopped as such. It is an off-road machine that just so happens to be designed to also go on-road if you need to. So it's got a hell of a lot of drawbacks. It's 50% upside, 50% downside. But as long as you know what it is and you're willing to put up with the annoying stuff to get the cool stuff, it's completely fine.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you had anyone try to buy it for you yet?
I've had a couple of people throw me an offer, and look, I've just bought a place, and it's an older place, and it's going to need more renovations than we first thought. So the chance of me selling it in the near future is actually going up by the day.
You probably make money off it too, given the demand.
You know what, though? I mean, I paid full whack for mine. I probably could have pulled some strings and got some favors. I've been around the block a few times, but I really wanted to pay full whack. I thought it was important that I didn't get special treatment just because of what I do for a living. But that then was $29,000, and they're going for a lot more than that now. So, you know, if I do have to sell it, I'm not going to take a haircut on it, that's for sure. But if you do see a blue and black manual Jimny with 11,000 Ks on car sales at some point soon, you'll know.
You're a busy man. You've got a lot to do. You've just bought a house. You're busy at work. If you just want to sling me the car, I'll buy you a slab and I can sell it for you if you want.
Interesting. But it depends on what your cut in this scenario is going to be, Scully. That's the problem.
Oh, no, you get the slab and I get the car.
Oh, what a deal. Yeah. Oh, what a score.
All I'm saying is your time is valuable. My time less so, I'd say. So maybe I can just deal with that for you.
I think all our time is valuable, isn't it, really? There's never enough of it.
All I can do is offer.
Good. Are you going to do a bit on your BMW as well, Mocha?
Who knows? So that's the other one. It's sitting out on the family farm at the moment, collecting dust. And you would know yourself, guys. And I know, Scully, you've got a car. Mandy, you've got a couple of cars. We love cars, but you just never get to spend time in them. You know, if you spend most of your time commuting, and then on weekends you got so much other stuff to do. So, you know, it's a passion project thing. I've got a few old cars and an old motorbike that are sort of sitting there doing not a whole lot. But who knows? Maybe. Maybe I'll engine swap it. EV convert it. Who knows?
I know at the moment my Pajero lives at my parents' place because I don't have street parking where I live in the garage spot that I've already taken from my girlfriend when I moved in with her. I use for press cars. So it's turned into mum and dad's like train station car, and then I get it from them when I need to go to the airport or when Maisie needs to drive further than maybe her 2006 Mazda 3 wants to. So
world's
it is a bit sad because they sort of sit there and you look and you go, I'd love to drive you more and I just can't.
Aww. The good thing about having an old Beta like that, though, is you can just park it anywhere and you don't care. Like, I'm going to park at Broadmeadows train station all night. I'm not taking the good car. I'm taking the old, you know, the old beat up project car.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm actually taking both my classics out this weekend. They're both involved in a wedding.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, so that's going to be a lot of fun. Actually, the groom, it's a Indian ceremony. So yep. Apparently they go for like a week. It's a rather long celebration.
So it's the Beetle and the 356 are both.
Yeah. But the really cool part is the groom called me and said, hey, I've got an interesting request for you. So apparently it's Indian tradition for the groom to ride in down the aisle on a white horse. He's like, don't want to do that. So he said, I thought maybe I can get a white convertible instead and sit on the back of it and pretend it's a horse. Stop it.
That is so cool.
I know. So I jumped at the opportunity because I'm like, I'm never going to probably be able to do this ever again. So, but typical Melbourne weather fashion, it's supposed to be pouring rain. So we'll see how we go with that.
You're going to need to have a marquee on top of the 356 to keep him undercover.
Oh, could you imagine? All right, let's get stuck into this week's show. News time. Scully, the 2021 Ford Mustang Mach-1. This is not great by Ford. It's missing some of the features that were advertised.
It is. The Mach-1 is kind of the flagship Mustang for Ford in Australia. The Bullet's all sold out and the GT lives on, but this is like a retro special. It's dressed up like the original Mach-1 with a whole lot of body add-ons. And Ford also promised some features that owners are starting to realize aren't actually going to be featured. We learned this from the Mustang Mach-1 Owners Australia group on Facebook, and a lot of them are really frustrated because when Ford promised the car, they said it was going to have a Torsen limited slip differential, but Ford Australia has actually said that the car we're going to get now is going to have the same rear diff as the Mustang GT and the Bullet. The Torsen diff uses internal gears instead of clutch packs. It's designed a little bit more for track work. Ford's actually had to republish brochures a couple of times to remove mention of some of the other features that at debut they said it would have, but then now won't be available locally. So rear parking sensors and adaptive cruise, both of which I would argue are things you'd really want on your expensive Mustang, aren't going to be standard on the Mach-1. Instead, you're going to get regular cruise and just a reversing camera on the car. And Ford's sort of justification for that is that it's meant to be the ultimate driving Mustang on road and track, which...
Yeah, but the American model gets it, though, doesn't it?
It does. It also is, you know, frustrating when the original materials that we were provided and that customs were provided said the car has something and now it doesn't. I mean, it's not a small amount of money to lay down, almost $84,000, close to $90,000 on the road, call it, which is about 20 grand more than a GT manual. Expecting certain things to be there and then they're not coming. Now, this sort of thing doesn't happen deliberately. Ford won't have set out to lie to customers. And we actually spoke on the podcast last year about a Subaru Liberty Final Edition that wasn't going to get some of the features that maybe they first expected. Sometimes it's down to someone in head office entered the wrong codes and now the cars have been produced. Other times it's down to the fact that there's a semiconductor shortage and part shortages. And the cars being sent to Australia just can't be built with those features, or you've been waiting forever for them. Whatever it is, though, I can understand why the owners are upset.
So people who've put money down on one of these going to get some sort of discount? Do they get some sort of favour out of Ford? in any way? Has Ford spoken about that side of things?
So we haven't got any confirmation from Ford about what is actually going to happen. It says they're working through how to best support Mach 1 owners in light of the information, and it says it's going to update them very soon. I know Subaru offered, I think, a discount on the Liberty or the option to give up your order slot. It wouldn't surprise me if that's part of what Ford does, because there's only 700 Mach 1s coming to Australia. There's a super passionate Mustang fan base. So if someone does give up an order slot, it wouldn't surprise me if someone else would swoop in pretty quickly to take it. But at this stage, there's no concrete information.
Customer Management 101, these are your most loyal, hardcore fans. Don't piss them off. So people don't like it when you get stuffed around like this, but they really don't like it if there isn't a good resolution. So Ford can salvage this. If it says, we'll give you $5,000 off the price of your car, you can cancel your booking with, you know, no strings attached. You know, you can come to a track day that we'll put on for you or something like that. They can definitely salvage it, but we should definitely be following up and making sure that they are. And I'm sure the guys and girls in the owners club will be keeping us well and truly in the loop on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Moco, Suzuki Australia is doing all sorts of things to try and cut waiting times on the little Jimny.
Yes, so we're speaking about Jimnys again. So basically Suzuki had a bit of a problem. It still does have a problem. The waiting list for the Jimny is more than a year. It currently holds more than 2,500 back orders that it hasn't been able to deliver the cars on, because the factory that makes them in Japan is this tiny little factory and worldwide demand is through the roof. So while waiting lists have become quite common for all cars, the Jimny is particularly badly affected at the moment. The company's made some back-end changes that are quite interesting, though. See, what it's been doing for now is the way that it allocates cars to dealers depends on how many vehicles a particular dealer sold. So if a dealer sold, say, 10% of all of the Suzuki sold within a certain geographical area, that dealer would get 10% of the next allocation of stock. The problem with that, of course, is most people order their Jimny through a big dealer, which means that they've got way too many orders to satisfy, whereas the smaller dealers may only be getting allocated 3 or 4 cars, but they may only have 3 or 4 orders. So you had this perverse situation where people who ordered their cars earlier were getting their cars after somebody who'd placed an order, you know, who only had to wait a couple of months as opposed to a year. It was a really clunky system. There was obviously a lot of complexities because the dealer networks, the bigger dealers wanted more cars, and there was a lot of political argy-bargy going on internally. But what it's done now is it's put in place a first in, you know, when you place an order, that is your spot in the queue now. So you order a Jimny, you're in the queue, the car is built to order, and you get your vehicle in the order in which you placed your order, which seems logical. Suzuki Queensland, which is a different distributor, not the same company as Suzuki Australia, has been doing this since day one. But in fairness, it's also a much smaller player with fewer dealers to have to negotiate with. So reading between the lines, Suzuki Australia has had to kind of fight a bit of a battle with its dealers, with the head office, just to try and smooth out this process, because we've heard from so many people that, you know, I've ordered a Jimny and I don't know when it's coming. I can't get any heads up on when it's going to arrive. Somebody who ordered one 2 months after me already has theirs. What is going on? So hopefully this back-end change will at least rectify that stuff. And the other side of the coin is supply looks like it will improve in the second half of the year. More allocation will be coming to Australia. So, you know, it's not a perfect situation yet, but it does seem like Suzuki is at least trying to address some of these structural issues that it had.
This does seem like something that more and more car makers are doing. We're seeing it with really high demand sports cars like the GR Yaris. And obviously some car makers are going further and managing things through an agency model for all sales. But with these low volume but really high interest enthusiast cars that people are desperate to get their hands on at the start and they don't really care where they get them from, it does seem like more and more car makers are going to do an online portal or some sort of centralized system so that the big dealers don't have advantages and it's harder for people to buy up stock and then sell it at a huge markup. It's good to see Suzuki doing the same.
Yeah, well, it should work for customers. So what we're hoping for is even if your waiting list is 12 months, at least as a customer, you can have a relatively clear idea from your dealer exactly when your car's going to arrive and you're kept up to date. You know, it's kind of like when you go on Uber Eats and you can track with a driver, right? If there's a delay, there's a delay, but at least you know what the situation is. And I think the most frustrating thing for a lot of people, and by all means not all people, but for some people, has been that lack of clarity. So it's not just the cutting of the waitlist that's important for me. It's the clarity of the waitlist. Suzuki reckons this is the answer to the woes. We'll keep an eye out on it and make sure that it is doing what the company says it will do. But for now, it looks like a pretty positive step.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of positive step as well, Scholar, we've got an update on Victoria and how it's going to commit to electric car subsidies. Tell us more.
Victoria has been a frequent member of this podcast recently because of its electric car subsidies and tax and all the stuff going on around it. It's still the only state in the country that is planning to tax electric vehicles based on how far they drive and also plug-in hybrid vehicles. But this week it's also come out and said that it will offer $3,000 subsidies for new electric car purchases under $69,000, not the really high-end stuff. It's also committed to making its fleet more electric, with $10 million have been set aside to buy 400 zero-emissions cars by 2023. And more charge points are going to be added to Victorian highways and major tourist destinations. So Victoria has finally decided that it needs to incentivize electric vehicles. This does feel like a bit of a pullback from its initial position of we're going to tax them and that's about it. And it also now puts Victoria more in line with the ACT and more recently New South Wales, which have announced plans to come out and to actually support the rollout of electric vehicles. It is also a slightly confusing position, though. Victoria has said to electric vehicle buyers, we want you to buy electric cars in the state. We are going to buy them ourselves. We also want to take money from you that no other state is taking from you. It's kind of a confused policy, and I'll be very surprised if, in the current form as we see it, this actually goes through the two houses of parliament, because it really doesn't make much sense to be supporting the rollout of electric cars but also doing something that, based on everything we know from around the world, will discourage their uptake.
So the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, which is the peak body for all the car brands, kind of got on the front foot about this during the week and proposed, you know, wholesale tax reform. I know that's a very boring subject that I'm not going to get into in depth, but essentially a road user charge makes a lot of sense, charging somebody by the amount of distance they drive if you can do it and get it accurate. You know, you don't want to have people having to keep logbooks just to have a car. You know, that's crazy. But it needs to be across every vehicle, and it needs to be in lieu of fuel excise. So everybody pays proportionate to the amount they use the roads and the weight they put on the roads, and that makes a lot of sense. The problem with this current model is it singles out EV owners who are actually doing a net good for society because they're helping to clean up the air and, you know, in their own small way mitigate CO2 emissions. So if you have a user mileage charge across all vehicle types and scrap existing taxes, makes a hell of a lot of sense. Right now, it's not that in Victoria. And so they're giving with one hand and taking with the other. And it's a very mixed, muddled, confusing message, I have to say. I have been calling for these sorts of subsidies for a while, so great that it's happening, but there is a caveat.
It's going to be really interesting to see, and I know that we end up talking a lot about this Victorian policy. I know also not all of our listeners agree with our perspective on it, and that is obviously completely fine because that's how this works. But it's going to be really interesting to see how this policy interacts with the rest of the country. You talk about logbooks and that sort of thing, and that is one of the major questions about this electric vehicle tax at the moment. The expectation is if you're an electric car owner, you're going to submit your odometer at set intervals and then pay the tax based on that. One of the questions I really want answered, and this is slightly sort of tangential, but if I'm driving in New South Wales, do I get to deduct how far I've driven on New South Wales roads based on my Odo reading and not pay that because it's a Victorian tax?
Yeah, and who's tracking it? You know, if I say to Vic Roads, no, I did 8Ks last year, and I actually did 80,000. Well, are they going to come round to my house? You know, and until we have vehicle to infrastructure communication streams where cars actually through 5G networks send their odometer to a centralized database that can then deduct it that way, which will happen. But for now, do you think people are going to be honest? There's going to be a lot of people who are driving 8Ks a week. So, yeah. Anyway, we're getting off track
here.
It's a very clunky system.
So. But they're, yeah, very good points you make there, certainly. And lastly, Moco, Ford is going to be selling ARB 4x4 accessories in dealers. I quite like this.
Isn't this just an ingenious move?
Yeah.
I've thought for a while that something like this would be a workable idea. I know that many manufacturers, it's not like I came up with this, manufacturers have been talking about doing this for a long time, but Ford's the one that's got it up. So basically what it is we know that the average dual cab ute buyer in particular, but also wagon buyer, spends a couple of grand going to ARB or Iron Man or Petters or whoever these aftermarket providers are, and they get new springs, canopies, bull bars, UHF devices, the works. Of course, car brands want a cut of that because that's a lucrative market they're missing out on. But the 4x4 enthusiasts love the aftermarket, particularly ARB. It's an Australian company with a worldwide footprint, and it's known for making stuff that's just better than factory standard, or at least as good as factory standard. So Ford's met in the middle and said, well, what if we do a deal with ARB to sell certain components, winch-compatible bull bars, electric winches, driving lights, storage drawers, suspension from old man EMU, etc., specifically made for the Ranger and Everest at our dealers. And then you pick up the car and it's already modified. And then we sling a cut to ARB and we get a cut ourselves and everybody's happy. It's a great idea. We don't know the specifics yet in terms of cost. So, you know, if I buy a Ranger and then go myself to ARB and have a consult, obviously it's less convenient, but I would expect to pay less too. You would imagine for the privilege of being able to just tick those boxes in a Ford dealership and get your car delivered to you as a turnkey solution, it's probably going to cost you a bit more. That's an important point. But on paper, on the face of it, it's rolling out in the second half of the year and all those questions will be answered in the fullness of time. But the idea of just being able to buy a Ranger and then pick it up a week later, fully modified by ARB at the dealer, that's an awesome service. And I think this is something that a lot of brands are going to be watching with interest. And also a lot of other countries are going to be looking at with interest. ARB has expanded all over the world now. It's massive in the United States. It's already making stuff for Bronco. It's making stuff for the American Ranger. I think the ultimate goal for this is for ARB to get a foothold in Ford dealers in the United States. Because imagine if, you know, those 1 million F-150s sold a year, imagine if 5% of those had ARB stuff on them. I mean, that would be the making of ARB. It would go from being a big company to an enormous corporation. Yeah. So you can see why ARB is excited by this. You can see why Ford's excited by this. I think it's a brilliant initiative. And I think other commercial brands should be watching this very, very carefully.
At risk of going a little bit too far with this, this is a really cool Australian engineering story because the Ranger is still heavily Australian influenced and developed in Broadmeadows and at the Yuyangs and that sort of thing. ARB is an Australian company done good on the global scale. It's really cool to see Ford dealers putting Australian developed and designed accessories on a car with heavy Australian input.
ARB is such an interesting company. 1975, the bloke who started it used to go make his own stuff to put on his 4x4 because back then there really wasn't any service like that. And realized that the stuff that he was fabricating in his shed was actually really, really good. So then made a company out of it. And now... yeah. I think it sells in somewhere like 140 countries around the world. It's headquartered in Melbourne, but it has R&D centers, you know, all over the place. Real Aussie success story.
We have a really good deep dive written by Vivek Shah on ARB's history and what it does now. So we'll drop that link into the podcast story if anyone is curious to learn more about the company.
Fantastic. Well, if you'd like to know more news, you can hit the news link at carexpert.com.au. April VFACTS figures have lobbed. How did we go with the new car sales figures for last month, Moko?
We went very, very well, Mandy. It was actually the all-time April record, and it was the sixth successive month of market sales growth. So after many years of consecutive declines, we're actually coming out the other side, although that's not particularly surprising when you consider that April last year We were in the middle of COVID shutdowns nationwide. So the fact that we had some massive sales growth has to be tempered in that sense. But just over 92,000 new vehicles were Canada sold last month. That's up 140% over April 2020, taking the annualized tally to just under 356,000 units, which is up 31%. So well and truly on track to pass that magical $1 million mark. Every state and territory saw growth with the population centres of New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, WA and South Australia all up by between 135 and 144%. So really consistent, strong growth across the market. In terms of brands, well, Toyota was far and away number one as per usual, double its nearest competitor. Mazda in second, and then Mitsubishi just hanging in there in third place, ahead of Ford, then Hyundai in fifth. Kia in sixth, Nissan, Subaru, Volkswagen, and MG once again inside the top 10. The Chinese brand MG up more than 600%, which is remarkable. The next tier positions included Isuzu, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, although if you take out vans, BMW outsold Mercedes-Benz, Honda, GWM, Haval,
Great Wall Haval, also up many hundreds of percent. Suzuki, Audi, LDV, Skoda, and Lexus, which makes four Chinese brands inside the top 20. So that part of the world, people are buying more and more cars from there en masse. Ford Ranger was the number one model with just over 5,000 monthly sales. And Toyota RAV4 finished second, not Toyota Hilux, as we have come to expect being in the top two with the Ranger. So Ranger 1, RAV4 2, Hilux 3, completing the top 10, Mitsubishi Triton, Land Cruiser Wagon, Mazda CX-5, Toyota Corolla, Mitsubishi ASX, and Hyundai i30. I've got a little stat here, which I thought was quite interesting. Now, if we take the best 25 selling vehicles in the market, they make up 53% of the total pie. So there are many, many hundreds of cars on sale, but the top 25 are the vast majority of the market. There were 13 SUVs inside the top 25 and six each of light commercial utes and passenger cars. So, surprise, surprise, SUVs continuing their dominance. Couple of miscellaneous facts and figures here. So, SUVs had 49,000 sales, up 170%, more than double the passenger car haul. In fact, more than the passenger car and light commercial haul put together. The top five market segments by share, 4x4 utes, number one, medium SUVs, number two, small SUVs, number three, then large SUV and small cars in fifth. Private buyers are actually driving this. So it's not big companies buying cars. Private buyers up 180% to 47,500 sales. So again, about half the market was private. Diesel and petrol obviously dominated, but hybrid up 170%. Electric and plug-in combined, though, just 0.6% market share. So we're not really seeing a heck of a lot of momentum coming from those alternate fuel vehicles. And in terms of the countries of origin, Japan, Thailand, and Korea, the top three. But then China, our number four sources of vehicles, I should say, ahead of Germany in fifth.
Moko, we've seen people holidaying at home really driving demand for cars like the Nissan Patrol and the Toyota Land Cruiser. How did the traditional towing vehicles and grey nomad cars go?
Yeah, so Scully, you're spot on. The demand for those cars is through the roof. Obviously, pickup trucks killed it, so there were six inside the top 25. Land Cruiser sales were at more than 2,500 units, 2,595 for the wagon. Nissan Patrol, always supply constrained. And we actually had the Ford Everest with nearly 1,000 sales. So what I would imagine would be an all-time record for that car. Toyota Prado, 1,400. Isuzu MU-X keeps on trucking on, about 900 units. So those sorts of vehicles continue to fly off shelves. I don't know how many more Land Cruisers Toyota has in stock. Every time we speak to them, they say they're almost out. And then every month, they sell 2,500 more. So I don't know what's going on there. But there's no doubt that the demand for these big vehicles that are capable of going on family adventures. I know Volkswagen spoke with James Wong during the week about how demand for their cars was flying as a result of it. People who can't travel are putting all their money into cars at the moment for that big family adventure, and big tough 4x4s and utes are the major beneficiaries of that.
Toyota must have a massive couch at the factory they keep looking under, and there's just more Land Cruisers there.
It's crazy. And like, you look on the classifieds, the Saharas are going for 170, 180 grand. It is just crazy money what they're going for at the moment. Supply and demand, you know, if somebody's willing to pay it, I guess, you know, all's fair. But, yeah, demand is just unbelievable.
There's a few really quirky brands that people like to take note of. How did the Skodas and the Alfa Romeos and those brands stack up?
Skoda did really well, actually. Skoda was up more than 700%, although a lot of that's down to the fact that they had a disastrous April 2020, but 936 sales. So inside that top 20, so definitely part of the furniture now is Skoda ahead of Lexus. Volvo car was up 176%. Jeep was up 265%. So we're seeing Jeep now really starting to recover some of that luster that it had a few years ago. Really every brand in market was well up, to be honest with you, with the exception of Renault, down 4.2%. But we know that Renault has just found an independent distributor, Ateco, who are going to replace the factory distributor. So there's clearly an issue with stock happening in that changeover period that would be responsible for that. But I mean, every other brand worth its salt just dominated last month. Genesis up 342%, albeit to 31 sales. So it's not exactly a high volume brand. Peugeot nearly tripled its sales. Mini more than doubled its sales. Porsche, the Taycan, was once again a hugely successful vehicle. And that company almost doubled its sales as well. So the growth really is almost across the board.
The full report, you can head to the website, and if you've got any questions, leave them in the comments section and Marco will eventually answer them, right?
Eventually I'll get to them, I promise.
The all-new Hyundai Tucson is here, and to find out what it's like, we welcome James Wong, who has spent some time with the medium SUV. Hello, J-Wo.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me back.
Pleasure. We'll get into all the details soon, but as I touched on last week, I'm interested to hear what you thought of the looks when you first laid your eyes on it.
I'll be honest, I wasn't the biggest fan of it because there's a lot of creases and lines in the bodywork, particularly through the sides, because they've sort of blistered the wheel arches and it all connects via the middle of the doors and everything. So it's kind of hard to explain because it's almost like this geometric pattern. Think of like Federation Square with all the triangles. It kind of looks a little bit like that. So when I first saw it, particularly because globally there are two versions. There's a short wheelbase version that's in Europe, and when we get the long wheelbase version that's available in like Korea, the US and whatnot. And in the longer guys as well, because it's substantially longer than the current one, and then it's got this like funny bodywork and really distinctive front and rear designs, it kind of just looked a little bit awkward from some angles. But in all fairness, I'm not sure if you guys have actually seen one in the flesh yet, but when you see them in person, it's much more resolved and much more in proportion. It might just be how sometimes with press photography, you've got, you know, different sources of light that they do and run the shutter speed mm-hmm. down so that you can light it from all different angles, and they all the editing that might sort of play with light differently than it does with natural sunlight. So I actually didn't mind how it looked when I got to see it in person. It didn't look as awkward.
So you mentioned the long wheelbase. How much bigger is the new Tucson than the last model? And also, does it compare to something like a Toyota RAV4 now?
Yeah, so it's 150 millimeters longer in overall length compared to the old one. So it probably isn't far off the size of a previous generation Sorento. So you think about how many different marks are doing that now. Like I think, Scott, you and I have spoken at length at like how your mum's X3, for example, is pretty much as big as the X5 that she had a decade ago. And the Tucson sort of grown to the point now where it sort of straddles the medium and large segments. So yeah, 150 millimeters in overall length, but the wheelbase has also increased by 85 millimeters. So it's a much bigger car. And then compared to something like a RAV4, this is probably closer in size to some of the larger vehicles in that segment. So you've got like X-Trail, CR-V and Mitsubishi Outlander that offer a third row. Those ones are about similar sizes to accommodate that extra row of seating. So this not only makes the car look bigger, but it's afforded a lot more space inside. So there's a much larger boot that with all the rear seats down is actually larger in quoted volume than a Santa Fe, which is quite impressive. It has like 1,800 litres with the seats down, which on this side of like a Passat or Superb wagon, you don't really get that sort of volume. Mm-hmm. And one of the sticking points or sore points with the old generation Tucson is that the back seat was a little bit on the tighter side. And I believe that the previous generation was really targeted at Europe. So, you know, quite a compact body. And then the rear seat space wasn't as big. So those are probably the main growth in dimensions per se. So yeah, it's definitely one of the larger cars in the segment, and it's much, much more practical compared to the old one.
Is there a chance we get the short wheelbase in Australia, or is it long wheelbase only?
At this stage, I think they're only doing the long wheelbase. The short wheelbase one is only manufactured in Europe for Europe, whereas even in South Korea, they only do the long wheelbase one to my knowledge. So at this stage, I think we're just sticking with that one. And I think it's probably the better one anyway, given Aussie buyers tend to, especially for families and stuff, you can actually have your kids start off there fairly young in it. And as they grow and, you know, they get taller than their parents in the back seat, they can still fit with plenty of room for them and their friends.
J-Wo, obviously one of the other things that have changed with this one is a different price. What is it, and where does it sit amongst the more premium brands in this segment?
So they've bumped up the base price by about $4,000 compared to the old one. So the old one you could get for like $30,000 drive away at certain points, which were very sharp drive away deals. But the new one, obviously being a much larger car, they've filled it to the brim with safety features. So now you pretty much get it decked out with all of the available safety features and driver assistance stuff from the base level. So it starts at just over $34,000 plus on-road costs. So you're probably approaching the $40,000 mark drive away on a base one. And then at the top end, there's the Highlander as a diesel is about $52,000 or $54,000. And then if you get the N-line package, it's more expensive again. So, you know, you're almost nudging the $60,000 mark drive away for the flagship versions of these. So you're not only competing with your typical mainstream rivals like RAV4, CX-5, CR-V, all that kind of stuff, but you're also sort of competing with some of the premium marks or the entry-level SUVs in those ones. And even though, say, you say like an Audi Q3 or a Mercedes-Benz GLA might dimensionally be smaller, I think what we've found, not only from our own research and speaking to different manufacturers, but also throughout the stuff that we've discovered at the Experience Center, which has been really invaluable, not just for myself as a journalist, but just for the team, is that a lot of people will buy or cross-shop different vehicles more so based on price rather than actual segments. So you'll have somebody that might be looking at a Tucson, a high-grade Tucson or CX-5 and be like, oh, it's $50,000 to $55,000. I can get a Mercedes or an Audi for that money that still suits my needs, even if the form factor is a little bit smaller or there might be some compromises. So I think it's worth acknowledging, which I have in my review, that there's quite a big set of competitors for this car based on model, price point and that kind of thing. You could probably, the most logical competitors for this in, from a premium perspective would probably be like the Audi Q3 and the Volvo XC40. more because they're a little bit larger and because they're quite boxy, they really prioritize rear seat space and boot volume, which will probably be more competition logically to the new Tucson.
There's a lot of variants. It's a very long price list. What are the different options that Hyundai has in terms of engines, and what's the new N-line actually mean? Is it a proper performance SUV?
So there's three trim levels, three different engine choices, as well as this N-line variant, which is not, is sort of a variant, but it's more of an option pack that you can add on every single trim level. So on the base car, it's about $3,500 because it adds a bulk of extra items that are normally reserved for the higher end models. And then it sort of gets cheaper as you go through the range because it adds less in terms of what features it actually adds. So the base engine, which is actually the only one that we drove at the launch, is a 2-liter naturally aspirated petrol engine, which instead of being direct injection like the old one, is one of their MPI ones, which is a multi-point one. And it's now got all the engines now have Smart Stream branding, which is Hyundai and Kia's umbrella term for their latest generation of engines with a raft of efficiency-based technologies. So that's the base engine. It's only front-wheel drive and it has a 6-speed automatic as standard, and that's available across the lineup, which hasn't been available before. And then there's also the 1.6-litre turbo and 2-litre diesels, which are basically updated versions of the previous range of engines, but they've also got the Smart Stream branding and a few different technologies built into them to make them more efficient. The two turbocharged versions are also all-wheel drive, but the petrol has a 7-speed dual clutch transmission, which is a dry type, not a wet clutch type, and then the diesel runs an 8-speed automatic.
Okay, so we better get into how it drove, Jaywo.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, we only drove the base petrol, so I'll have to reserve my final judgment for the whole range until I can actually, or the rest of us can get our hands on the other vehicles. So the turbo ones come in the next month or so, and then the diesels come in the third quarter, so you're looking more just after mid-year. So we did a really long extended drive from Sydney through to Orange, which is in regional New South Wales. It's about a 3.5-hour trip from Sydney. So I spent a lot of time in this car. So it's a long time to have the one engine, but it also gave me an opportunity to see what the different wheel and tire packages did or made a difference between the different trim levels. So I started off in the base car, which has 17 or 18-inch alloys with chubby tires on it. That's a really comfy, quiet thing to sit in. It's, even though it's quite basic in terms of its spec, or at least its trimmings and fit out, the cloth seats are really comfy. The interior is well insulated from wind and road noise. And the way that it drives, so even though it's a bigger car and it's got less power than the old one at the with this base engine, it's actually decent enough, I think, for most people. So I think we found that most people that buy these kinds of cars are probably going to stay in town. They're going to do the school drop-off, or they're going to go to the shops, or, you know, they might do the occasional freeway trip into the city or somewhere that's not too far away. I think for those duties, this engine is fine. It won't set your pants on fire or anything like that. It's still a very basic engine, and it does its best work between 0 and 80 kilometers an hour. But once you get up to those freeway speeds, on a flat freeway, maybe it's fine. But once we started hitting the Blue Mountains and getting through to Orange, there was a lot of winding country back roads that had signed speed limits of 100. And, you know, you've got really steep inclines, and it just didn't have the guts for that stuff. And after you get past about 4,000 RPM, it really just doesn't have a lot to give. So it makes a bit of noise. It sort of holds on to gears. It doesn't feel like it's really shifting enough. And, you know, there was just me in the car at the time. If you had a full load of kids and family members or luggage, I'd imagine that you'd probably struggle with that kind of stuff.
You mentioned the noise. What is the refinement like behind the wheel on the highway? Does it feel pretty comfortable and quiet?
Yeah, it actually does. So the Tucson's actually now based on a shortened version of the Santa Fe and Kia Sorento platform. So it's sort of got like a big car feel in a smaller car package. And the way that the old one sort of felt like an enlarged, maybe like i30 or Serato, where the levels of refinement probably weren't up there with some more expensive vehicles. This one feels a lot more quiet and settled, particularly at freeway speeds. So all three versions with various tire and wheel combinations actually were pretty refined over smooth roads, coarse chip surfaces. And I did quite an extended stint of rough dirt road in the Highlander, which has the biggest wheels. It's like a 19-inch wheel and skinnier tires. And the level of refinement and comfort was pretty consistent across the board. Obviously, there's like little differences in terms of, like, you know, the ones with bigger wheels will pick up some of the smaller bumps in the road a bit more. But other than that, I came away quite impressed, because that segment in general, particularly for the mainstream brands, can be a bit of a mixed bag. There are some older cars that get a bit noisy, a bit unrefined, and the Tucson actually in its previous generation was one of these. It was just sort of getting on a bit and wasn't super efficient. The engine performance wasn't great and a bit noisy, whereas this one just feels a lot better. And I think that with one of the turbocharged engines, it would just really complete the car. With this base petrol, it's probably like, for me personally, maybe 80 or 85% of what the vehicle's capable of. It just needs that extra layer of, you know, that load down torque, and perhaps the all-wheel drive system would be better in adverse weather conditions. But we had a mix of, you know, torrential rain while we were going up there. I had obviously had the dirt section, and not once did I feel like there was no grip or that I needed all-wheel drive to feel safe. The fundamentals of this vehicle are very, very capable and very, very refined. So it's already a good thing, and with these additional powertrains, it can only get better.
Let's talk about interior. How did you find it? Was it easy to make your way around it?
Yeah, so I know that a lot of people probably will have seen pictures of it and go like, oh, that's really like future age. It's got this weird waterfall style center stack with the screen and touch capacity buttons and the steering wheel's four spokes and looks like something out of a spaceship. But it's actually quite conventional in the layout of everything. You sort of reach around. All the main controls are within arm's reach of the driver. It didn't really confuse me in terms of how everything was positioned. The only thing you really have to adjust to is those touch capacity buttons on the center stack. If you're driving and you're trying to glance over and see what you're touching, if you're not used to it yet, that's probably one small learning curve. But other than that, the steering wheel, all the multifunction controls are really easy. They fall nicely within reach of your thumb. The digital instrument cluster in the Highlander, and as part of the N-Line package, regardless of which model that you get, is really easy to read and use. It's pretty much straight out of all the other Hyundai models that have it. So it's all familiar stuff. And then even the central infotainment system, it's the same screen that you get in like a Kia Seltos or a high-grade Hyundai Kona. The menus are all the same. So Hyundai and Kia, I think, have really done well with making sure that their new tech is quite user-friendly. And one line I said in my review is that with the infotainment system, a tech head who's really obsessed with, like, you know, touching things and going through functions, as well as their grandma, could probably use it really easily, because what you touch goes to a logical menu. You go to settings, all the stuff's there. It's all very clearly labeled. It's really snappy to respond, and it's got a really high-definition screen regardless of which model you get. So the base one gets an 8-inch screen, and the higher-grade ones get a 10.25-inch screen. Really high resolution, snappy to respond. There's not much you can ask for.
has Hyundai finally fixed its problems with wireless CarPlay, or does the base model still have a system that always drops out?
So, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to try that because those models were the only ones that had like a phone plugged in to do the drive route navigation. So, I didn't actually get to plug my phone in and see if it dropped out. I know that previously we found that you can't actually wire a connection with CarPlay and Android Auto with those systems, even if you disconnect from the wireless function. So even though these phones were plugged in and charging, they were Android phones and not once did it drop out. It was great. So if that was connected wirelessly, which I'm not sure if it was, it was fine. And then the wired connection in the higher grades that I used for navigating from Orange to Sydney again worked beautifully. And I actually have started using Google Maps more because I've got the satellite view and like with those high resolution screens, it actually looks really cool. So, yeah.
It does sound like a very clever way to avoid having to talk about wireless CarPlay not working. But anyway, we'll find out on that one when we get it through the garage.
Maybe, yeah.
All right, that review you can check out at carexpert.com.au. We'd love to see what you think of it too. James Wong, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
The Volkswagen Amarok just got even more ballsy with the release of the Amarok W580. It's the result of VW teaming up with the local tuning firm Walkinshaw. VW have dubbed it the ultimate GT spec ute, Scully. You've driven this. Would you agree with VW?
I think it's probably not far off the mark, actually. It was a pretty bold claim because there are a lot of utes out there that have been hotted up or modified or made tougher or made more expensive. But Volkswagen and Walkinshaw have taken a really interesting path with this car. And I think that claim probably rings true in the real world.
Okay. So what sort of stuff has Walkinshaw done to the Amarok?
So I suppose to start with, it's worth mentioning that Volkswagen went to Walkinshaw a couple of years ago and said, we want to do a special edition Amarok. What do you think we should be doing? And Walkinshaw came back with two proposals. And the first one was a Ford Ranger Raptor rival. And the second one was a proper road-going ute that'll still do the off-roading stuff and the towing stuff, but is more planted and settled at speed and handles a bit better. And Volkswagen decided on the second one because the Amarok is known for having a really powerful engine. It's got an awesome turbocharged V6 under the bonnet. And it also has some really refined road manners already. So when Walkinshaw said we can improve it, they said, that really feels like playing to our strengths. Let's do that. So this car is being built. Obviously, the car is built by Volkswagen first. It's then taken to Walkinshaw in Clayton, which is in Victoria, where they apply all the upgrades, they check it over, and then it goes out to dealers from there. The first batch of these sold out online really quickly. You're going to struggle to get your hands on one before the end of financial year, although maybe you'll be able to, is what we've heard. But Volkswagen and Walkinshaw actually plan to build these for 2021 and 2022. All told, they're expecting to build about 2,000 cars. And there's also potentially early next year going to be an off-road brother for it. We know nothing about it beyond that Volkswagen really wants to make it happen. But come early 2022, there could also be the option of a Volkswagen Amarok W580 Warrior or Raptor, or I know they can't use those names because someone else already has, but there could be more than 2,000 of these Walkinshaw and Volkswagen Amaroks built eventually.
That would look insane with big fat tires, wouldn't it?
It definitely. One of the things I think is cool about this is that it's quite subtle compared to a Raptor. It still looks more menacing, but Volkswagen and Walkinshaw haven't gone over the top. The idea of something a little bit pared back on the outside, but with all the presence of big chunky off-road tires and a bigger lift and maybe a winch or something on the front, it could be one of the coolest looking utes out there. The changes on the outside are pretty significant when you see the car in person. They look subtle in the photos, but there's a new front end on it. There's new wheels and guard extensions. There's some quite subtle compared to what you can get elsewhere, stripes and add-ons to the exterior with stickers. Side steps, sports bars, just the usual array of ute upgrades. The real changes are under the skin. So to start with, Walkinshaw has given it a new suspension system. It's got twin tube dampers with a fatter internal bore and a thicker damper shaft. Walkinshaw says that bore allows for more fluid in the damper, which lets it fiddle more precisely with how the car actually rides. There's also a lift kit, which makes the car sit more level. It's 40 millimeters higher at the front. And it rides on those 20-inch wheels that are wider than stock, and they're wrapped in Pirelli Scorpion tires that, although they don't look all that different to the stock tires, make a big difference when it comes to grip on the road.
Any performance upgrades?
Unfortunately not. So under the bonnet is still a 3-litre V6 diesel. It's got 190 kilowatts of power and 580 newton metres of torque, which is still best in segment before you go to the big V8 Ram utes. There's also overboost that gives you 200 kilowatts for short bursts, in case that wasn't enough. there is a unique exhaust in the W580. Volkswagen and Walkinshaw say it's freed up the mid-range of the engine a little bit more. It makes the car sound more purposeful on the outside. From behind the wheel, there's not a huge difference that you can attribute to it, really.
Okay. I'm assuming you've driven the normal Amarok without all the Walkinshaw stuff on it. How would you compare the ride to the W580?
So the changes are definitely subtle. We actually, one of the other journos on the event has an Amarok, a V6 550, and I said to him, what do you think the differences are? And he sort of said, they're definitely there, but you also need to tune your bum in to feel them. Right. And I think that's accurate. So to start with, I mean, the way it looks is definitely better, and that does count for something, but at low speed, the suspension feels a little bit firmer, little bumpy roads and pimply bits in the city. They're nowhere near horrible. It still rides very nicely at low speed, but the car is definitely a little bit more firm over those. The trade-off is when you hit highway speeds, in most of these utes, when there's nothing in the tray, they feel quite like light and floaty at the back. Mm. If you hit sharp bumps, the back wants to skip around a little bit, and they can often sort of take one or two or three movements to deal with dips and crests in the road. So you go over a bump and the car goes up and then down and up and down as it controls its weight. There's none of that in this car. Even over big, yucky highway crests and dips and that sort of thing, it sort of just takes the hit and just settles straight back down. So although it's a little bit firmer than the normal Amarok, it also feels a little bit more controlled. And when you're driving at 100 or 110 k's an hour on the highway with nothing in the back, that's a really big step forward. The other thing that's changed is the track is wider, the wheels are wider, the suspension's slightly different. One of the things the Walkinshaw engineers we spoke to told us about was that they've tried to make the car feel a little bit sportier and handle with a bit more grip at the front end. And you'll notice in a lot of these utes as well that because they are designed to be driven, you know, with a load in the back and also be driven by people who aren't necessarily in a hurry, there's quite a lot of safety understeer built in, which completely makes sense. That's not a criticism of the way most utes handle, because you'd much rather they're safe than they're pointy race cars that people keep going backwards off the road in. But what the Walkinshaw guys have done is just tighten up the front end on the Amarok slightly. And especially on gravel, you really notice that when you turn the wheel, there's far less slack in it. It sort of wants to go a little bit more directly, and it's got more grip once you actually turn into a corner. So obviously, it's still a ute. You still hit some bumps and it still skips around a bit. It's still big and heavy. But on long, sweeping highway corners and even some tighter stuff, the combination of the way that it soaks bumps up and also the way that the steering feels a little bit more direct at the front, there's sort of less slack in the middle of it, makes it feel like a ute you actually could really have some fun on a twisty road in. That shouldn't come as too much of a surprise, because the Walkinshaw team has some real experience. They, along with converting the Ram 1500 for a Tico and the Chevy Silverado for GM SV, members of this team are also members of the team that did the HSV GTSR, among other cars. So when it really comes down to it, these guys know what they're doing. And although the difference isn't massive to the normal Amarok, which I would argue is probably already the most car-like of all the utes to drive, it definitely just feels that little bit more settled and that little bit sportier on twisty roads.
I'd love to see that on the track.
It'll be interesting, actually, because Volkswagen has got a history of doing that. One of its apprentice cars was a Time Attack Amarok that we've just heard through the grapevine was actually faster than a super ute around around certain tracks.
Wow.
So, yeah, the Amarok, which, I mean, the other thing worth mentioning is that the engine in it is just is the nicest engine in any ute you can buy before you get to the big V8 stuff. 580 newton meters doesn't sound like all that much more than the 500 you get in some utes, but it's a big 3-liter V6, and the way it delivers the torque, it feels like almost like the sort of engine you'd get in a Touareg. That shouldn't be surprising, because his engine was in the Touareg for a little while. So at highway speed, you lean on it a little bit and it just holds its gear and relies on the torque and the displacement it's got and pulls you along without dropping down. And you put your foot down to overtake and it pins you back in your seat much better than any other ute. Volkswagen's selling point with the Amarok has long been that V6 engine. It's now got a couple of different tunes of it, a whole lot of different models. And even in 2021, where this car is 10, 11 years old, which means it's missing some stuff that we should probably talk about, but that engine still holds up.
Okay. what is it missing?
I'm glad you asked. So for starters, there's no rear curtain airbags, which if you're carrying kids around in this car, and a lot of ute buyers now are, is a black mark against the Amarok. It has none of the active safety stuff that some of its rivals have. There's no AEB, there's no active cruise, there's no blind spot, which I know some owners won't be worried about. We spent a lot of time on the highway in this car and it wasn't a problem. You can still, you know, get anywhere you want to go with it and you'll be fine. But given cheaper utes, this thing now costs between $73,000 and $80,000. Cheaper utes have a full spread of active safety kit. This really should as well. And obviously when the new model arrives in partnership with Ford, it will. But in the meantime, you are paying a lot for a ute that lacks a lot of modern technology. I think the last thing is if you sit in the back of it, it's really wide. The body has a lot of space. So three broad-shouldered people, I just pointed at myself. I don't know why I did that because I'm a skinny rake of a person. But three broad people can sit shoulder to shoulder and have less of a problem than in most utes. But legroom's really average and there's no air vents back there. There's no power plug like you get in a Ford Ranger. So for everything it does well, and I can completely understand why you'd buy it. I think if I had to buy a ute tomorrow, I'd want one of these because it drives so well. If you're using it day to day, you're trying to use it as a family car, there are definitely some flaws that mean it struggles to stack up to some of the other newer utes.
Okay. Well, that review, if you'd like to take a look, it's such a cool thing. Head to carexpert.com.au and let us know what you think of Scully's review. Okay, that's an end for this week's podcast. Some events and launches that we've got coming up next week. Scully, fill us in.
So James Wong is driving the Bentley Bentayga V8, just a car of the common man. I'm up in Canberra driving the Audi Q2, SQ2 and SQ5. Very excited to see how those stack up. And pending the COVID situation, we'll also be up at the Car Expert Experience Centre. And then the week after that, we have got the Kia Niro electric vehicle coming through the office. Really excited to see how that stacks up. On a launch loan that we can do a video with as well. And there's a Volkswagen Tiguan briefing coming after that too.
Fantastic. And what cars have we got coming up in all of our garages as well, Moko?
So at the moment, I'm driving a Haval H6, the new generation Chinese mid-sized SUV, which is under an embargo, so I can't tell you what I think of it. We've got the recently updated Peugeot 308 GT Sport, the plug-in hybrid MGHS up in Sydney. What are some other interesting ones? We've got a Rugged X Hilux versus a Navara Pro 4X, which is that newly launched Navara range topper that I'm doing out of Melbourne next week. The Niro EV, as Scully just mentioned, Focus ST line. We haven't really done a lot of Ford Focus content lately, so it'll be good to get back behind the wheel of that. A sequence of new, or I should say updated, Volkswagen Tiguans, including the 147 TDI, which I think looks very interesting indeed. Audi SQ2, Wrangler Rubicon. We are loaded up with cars, I have to say. We have got more cars than people for the next few weeks, so it should be fun.
Plenty of reviews coming up at the site very soon, no doubt. Mike Costello and Scott Colley, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks, Mandy.